Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. I really wish the sun would come out because it's raining and it's horrible out there, but we're going to heat it up in here. But first, I wouldn't be me if I didn't embarrass somebody and my family on their birthday. I have to do it. They do it to me all the time. So my nephew, who is the proud owner, I am very proud of him, of Davy Fit Bodies, the hottest gym in town. No wonder I'm so skinny and fit whenever I get down there. It's on 12940 West State Street in State Road at 84 in Davie, Florida. His name is Jason. He's going to be 46 today, the old guy, but he looks about 26. And his aunt wants to wish him happy birthday. And if I didn't do that, my sister, who's up there somewhere high above, would probably not be very happy with me if she was here. So happy birthday, Jason. And we're going to keep this. This is going to be very interesting. This is Literary Viewpoints. So we're going to be talking about the Brussels attacks. They also attacked Nigeria and Pakistan. And from what I gather, they're not done yet. So within this world, there are people that feel that their way of thinking is right, and that anyone disagrees with them doesn't deserve to live. How did they come to think like this? And why have they gotten so powerful? How did we not see this?
Brent?
That's a hard point. Yeah, I'm here. That's my question.
Okay, I was wondering if you're posing that to me or just posing that.
No, that's
you.
There's nobody else. There's nobody else going to answer these questions.
Okay.
I'm not going to answer them.
Okay. Well, you know, the question is, one, you know, how do these powers spring up without this thing?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a very important question. You know, certainly, you know, with the rise of ISIS seems to come out of nowhere. And none of the intelligence community seemed to know it. When we had the attacks in France and then Belgium, the question was, where were the intelligence communities? You know, but we have to, you know, also look back and remember when 9/11 struck, you know, we were completely blindsided. We were caught with our pants down. Our intelligence communities were not, you know, aware of the threat. Though in retrospect, we talked about things that we saw happening, you know, as the CIA director said, you know, all red lights were flashing. But I know, you know, the FBI, terrorism was not a high priority. We didn't really consider it a serious threat. And then we were caught off guard just looking in Boston during the marathon bombing. You know, everyone says, why weren't you watching the Sarnia brothers? So there's just a big, big world out there, which doesn't excuse us and doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing the best we can and intelligence communities cooperating. But you just can't monitor everything all the time.
I know. It's scary.
It is really scary.
Just It is frightening because you never know, you know, what they have in mind. And I was reading on the news list that I was listening this morning to channel whichever, and they said, who, first of all, there's a link between the Brussels attacks and the Paris attacks, right, in November. And then there was a mistake or oversight that Belgium made that attributed to what happened, because they actually had the guy and then they let him go, which was really not wonderful either. So what did the EU countries have to do? What does Belgium have to do to keep their people more secure and pay attention when Turkey, I believe, sent the guy over there and they just let him go? How could they not see what was happening?
Well, again, this comes to a matter of communications and a recognition that we talk about sovereign nations. So, you know, we get in the EU and we have a Schengen area, and we know that that's a very, you know, the passport free zone, as we call it, the ability to travel throughout Europe without having to show a passport every border. You know, that was designed to, you know, for the economy and for tourism. And it's great for that, and have people travel, and it encourages all sorts of money coming and going from the tourism trade. But it was not designed for security, and not, you know, a free society and, you know, commercialism isn't always in line with security, and we know that. You know, it's always a balance of what we're going to do, but yet we want people out there being comfortable shopping and enjoying themselves. So we know that's not for security. So we have people traveling from country to country, crossing borders, and now we're going to sovereign nations, and to some extent they share information, to some extent they don't, and there's always going to be a, you know, loss of intelligence when you have sovereign nations that aren't going to turn everything they have over to another country. I mean, look, just in this country here, you know, I know we keep talking about how things changed after 9/11, but you know, I was in the FBI after 9/11, and we still were not sharing information with all our other agencies. We still had, you know, these turf wars. Not that things didn't get better. They did. They got a lot better after 9/11. I don't want to mischaracterize that, but they weren't perfect. There was still information was not getting back and forth. We're a little proprietary. We always worry about someone leaking information. Well, think of that on the international scope. Governments want to trust other government with. So we're far away from having this universal worldwide database, which we'll probably never have. Mm. And this is what's going to happen.
It's scary. It's scary. And what really is even scary, I was listening. My husband loves to listen to the radio early in the morning, and I was getting my hair done. It's 6 o'clock on Saturday, and he had NYC on, and it was very interesting. There was a man, I don't know if the show was taped or live at that point, early in the day. There was a man that actually spent 10 days in ISIS, in the ISIS state with this group, and it was mind-boggling to listen to him. And my question at the end was, seriously, because I want to go through all these, what would happen if they actually got what they wanted, is what he asked. What would happen if they actually got the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria? Would they stop there? Or would they want more?
I doubt it. Again, we're looking at these people who just have this view of themselves, of power, and that they're right.
Yeah.
I mean, they just believe that they're right. I mean, we see the expansion under Nazi Germany. You know, we have to control the world. It's not enough to control a country. They believe that what they profess is the correct way for everyone to live. And once you get what you want, what does that tell you? Oh, this is working. Whatever I'm doing is working. I can get more power. I'm going to get more power. I get whatever I want, through this violence, through acts of terrorism. Why negotiate? Why back down? So I'd have to, I'm sure we'd all agree that there'd be nothing to be gained. Not that we would anyway, but there certainly would be nothing to be gained by ever capitulating to terrorism.
No, definitely not. And it's scary because the fact that all these there were three young men involved in this particular in the Belgium, and two of them blew themselves up and actually probably believe that they're up there someplace having fun with some girls in paradise. I don't think so. I think they're blown to bits. They just didn't really realize that. I mean, it's scary with security in airports and stuff like this, and even here, the supposedly security is high. How do you walk in to an airport with a bomb and nobody sees it? How did they get away with that? I mean,
we have
scary
to remember we have to remember, what it is we're trying to protect. And in airports now, the goal has not been, heretofore, to protect the airport. Our goal has been to protect what? The airplane. Again. So that's where all our security is designed, is to keeping bombs, explosives, weapons off the plane. So now we can look at it and say, all right, well, we want to increase security at the airport, at the ticket counters. So that would take, again, a new plan. So now we'd have to move out what we call that perimeter. So, example, we have a perimeter around the gates where we scan you and we check, your luggage and do all that stuff. We'd have to move that out. So you move out that perimeter, but you're always going to have a place where the inner perimeter meets the outer perimeter, where you have security, which means people waiting for security. So it's always going to be a choke point where people are waiting to enter that, secured area. So no matter what you do, there's going to be this area that's vulnerable. So if we expand the scope and we're going to protect the physical airport itself, say, all right, don't get into the gates, but now you have to be checked a mile out, there's still going to be a crowd of people waiting to get into that perimeter. So there's always going to be a gathering, a choke point of people that could be target. And if that becomes too difficult, they just go somewhere else. So we have to take the reality that we can't just protect everything. It's an uncomfortable reality and not one that we really want to accept. But it is a reality. We just can't protect every place at every moment. They could always move, and we're always going to have that vulnerability. There's always going to be a spot where security ends and vulnerability begins.
You know what's scary is that they've actually gotten on airplanes. That's what's even scarier. Even after the airport security and all the rest of it, how did they manage to hijack planes? I mean, they managed to do that eventually.
That's been,
like
I know.
Malaysia
that
last year, that nobody knows what happened to that other plane.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, we had that one recent incident. Again, hijacking is not really something that's been a security problem in recent history. So we had that one. There's always going to be a lapse of security. Again, you get into these other countries, there's always a possibility, well, in any country, it's the possibility of corruption, at key areas with key people. There's always a possibility of just really human error and errors in processes that someone just gets by something. But again, those incidents are very rare in terms of actual hijacking a plane. In terms of people traveling, again, there's still phony identities out there. There's still people that we just don't know about. Not everybody's on the radar. Not every wannabe would-be terrorist or violent person that we know about. We can't, you know, foresee that coming unless, you know, we have intelligence about them. They're sitting on some no-fly list or the equivalent in another country, and we know they're coming. But the fact that someone travels and then commits a terrorist act later on is really not a fault of any particular security service or the airline. It's just we couldn't have known that. Again, just another one of these uncomfortable vulnerabilities with which we just have to understand they exist.
That is scary. It is scary. I mean, you know, you even walk into Grand Central or you walk into Penn Station and you see the armed guards there and everything after what happened in Brussels. So there's a lot of security down there. But after a while, it's not there anymore. So
Well, that's exactly right.
That's what's scary, because if you know that there's the capabilities, why are you taking away the security? And then the mayor of my fair city, well, I don't have him anymore, but when they get rid of police presence and fire police and take off firemen and all that, I mean, that's insane. But you see the police presence in Grand Central, because I was there a few weeks ago, and then all of a sudden the threat's gone, so that means that there's no more police presence, and they watch that, I'm sure.
Well, the problem is with security, a lot of it is optics. Some of it is a feel-good measure. You know, after something happens, then, of course, we always worry, well, there might be a second shoe to drop or there might be a copycat, so we increase the police presence.
Yeah.
But exactly what you, if that's exactly what you said, then we don't have the presence anymore, and it just makes it all that more enticing. And also, a lot of times, that police presence is really not going to stop necessarily what's going, the type of activity that we're worried about. You know, it might be a deterrent if someone doesn't, you know, really doesn't have a clear idea what they want to do. But, you know, I hate to just give out ideas, which is why I'm kind of not getting specific about what I'm saying. You know, but there's certain things that they can do that would really render that police presence ineffective. But, you know, we need it. People want to see that after an attack. They want to feel that, you know, the government. But, unfortunately, as you said, we don't keep that up. And so often when I hear that, you know, after a terrorist attack, that, you know, TSA or someone else, they've increased the level of security, it makes me wonder, what have we been doing otherwise? You know, what haven't we been doing? And sometimes I wonder, is that real, or is it just, you know, some illusion we're trying to give? There shouldn't be any vulnerability that we're patching up now after the fact.
Well, I know when I went to Florida last year, they have a check-in list online. So I was able to check in online, which is great, because I gave them you know, answers to all my questions. And which is a great thing, because it saved me a lot of time. But they don't know if you're telling the truth. They don't know
if they
should know, but they don't know. But yet, you're still going on the same line. Afterwards, you're just faster to go through the security line. And I have to tell you, I went on JetBlue. They're amazing. Because if they even think that you look weird, they pull you over. And that made me feel a lot better. Yeah, they're amazing.
Yeah, I don't know that the airlines now have their own security as opposed to just all TSA or TSA contractors. But, you know, I know I was a couple times randomly selected for the pre-screen, you know, going in, you know, not to be searched. And I'm thinking, well, you know, does this really make sense? You know, if what they have isn't good enough to find something on my computer or something else, we shouldn't be doing it. You know, I think the public has come pretty acceptance of security without it getting excessive. Again, you know, no one wants to be molested unnecessarily, but we've become, you know, pretty aware of the fact that we have to have good security, and we accept the inconveniences of it. I mean, I remember there was a time when, you know, if you got patted down and wanted, it was like a big embarrassment. Nobody even cares anymore. You know, it's you go there, it's you know. So I think we have to be, and we have to be careful about making it. You know, convenience is nice, and we feel better about it, but not at the expense of security. So I always feel if we're making this convenient, and we know that certain people are not going to be searched and under certain circumstances, and certain people will have a low level of security, that could easily be exploited by someone who knows what they're doing. So those things kind of worry me, though I myself like to get on the pre-screen line and rush through, but I have to hope there's still adequate security there should I have been improperly put on the pre-screen.
Yeah, I do the pre-screen also. It's just that coming home last year, my bracelet went off. And I had no idea that it was my bracelet that went up, but the guy did. The security guy
right.
did. He said, he looked at me and he said, give me your bracelets, whatever, your jewelry. So I did. I gave it to them. And he said, that's what was knocking you off. Don't worry about it. I was like, oh, my God, I'm so embarrassed. But it was I didn't realize my bracelet was metal. And at least he didn't make me feel bad. And he said, I have a feeling that, well, those, you know, things that you're wearing on your arm, I think that's what's doing it. So I was lucky, but they were pulling people over, and the lady that was wanding people was not very pleasant. So I was like so happy that he realized it was my bracelet that did it. But this was interesting also that they had in the paper. I've been reading a whole bunch of stuff about these attacks. The taxi driver that carried these three guys, what the heck was going through his mind when he realized that it was his cab that was carrying these three terrorists? That must have been scary.
Well, I think it came after the fact, and he cooperated. He did the right thing. He went right to the police and brought them right back to the house and said, I think this is it. I mean, that's exactly what we want from the public.
Yeah.
That's exactly heads up. He doesn't know at the moment, and we can't expect everyone to be alert. Not everybody's a police officer.
Yeah.
You know, we don't expect everyone to go around there and you're looking for suspicious activity. You know, that turns to vigilantism, which only turns to trouble. But it's heads up. It's just heads up, and it's just staying alert. Again, as we always say, alert to your surroundings. We always talk about that. See something, say something. This was a great example of that. Somebody recognized that he may have seen what was a terrorist attack. He cooperated, and it helped the police. So that was, good work. That guy deserves a lot of kudos.
He does. He's also lucky to be alive. He was just very
lucky. Well, I mean, I don't think he was necessarily in any danger at the moment, but he did the right thing. And that's all the police want the public to do is just cooperate, not take action on your own. Don't try to be a hero. Just do the right thing. And look how well that works if you just do the right thing.
He's lucky. It's just too bad it didn't save all those people in Belgium, though. So does Belgium, I was reading also, see, I've been doing a lot of research to make sure, does Belgium have a community of young people that are being trained to be part of ISIS, part of this group? And what causes them to feel that they have to live that type of a life? And what about their parents? What are they missing? What is anybody missing
right.
with them? It's sad.
Okay.
It's sad.
It is. You bring up a point. Belgium certainly come on the spotlight since the attacks. And now, of course, looking at statistics, they realize that, given this population, proportionally, they have more people going over, going over to Syria to get trained or wherever to join ISIS, and do that proportionally speaking. So then we have to worry, what are the socio-demographics going on, in Brussels or Belgium that is creating this? And, one of the things we looked at, we're always asking, even though we've had it in the United States, we've had it in very small numbers, and certainly small numbers proportionally, given the size of our population. And again, these usually are not people necessarily uneducated or poor or anything like that, but it's a feeling of being disaffected. And one of the aspects you always hear people discuss is the integration of people into society, and that the Muslim community in the United States is much more integrated than they are in Europe. So there's less of this feeling that you have to rebel, you have to retaliate or find this connection. Through ISIS or any other terrorist group, and take action against your own people. So one of the important things is that the more hatred we spew here in the United States, the more we make ourselves vulnerable to becoming more like Europe and having more of these young people become vulnerable to being radicalized and going overseas. So really, the answer is not hatred. It's not bigotry. It's not to point out. It's to be accepting of people who they are and continue along the way that the United States is, sort of a blended society the best we can be. And that kind of helps fight terrorism rather than leads to people being radicalized.
I know. It's scary because I sit and I listen – not too often, to the reaction of the government and the candidates for president and their reactions and statements. And I'm listening to them and I'm saying there's not one that has addressed any of the issues of safety, security, education, health, anything in the right way. It all becomes like a dissing contest to see who can insult somebody else even more. And hate is a word that needs to be taken out of the dictionary. It's scary. It's a very dangerous word, and kids are learning it. I mean, when I hear anybody, any one of my nieces or nephews say, "I hate you," which I haven't really, I go, "That's a terrible word." You can say, "I dislike what you did," or "I would prefer that you didn't do that," but I don't want to hear that word because that is a horrible, horrible word that leads to all sorts of everything. Why is it that no one seems to have, the candidates haven't addressed it? And I haven't seen any one of them that I feel comfortable with, to be very honest, that has addressed
right.
anything with terrorism and, the ISIS is going to go, you know, they're not going to make it. Yeah, okay, I don't think so. I mean, even the guy that was on NYC said that the people that are in this particular group of ISIS, he said they only have one narrow-minded idea about the Quran. They don't really understand the whole thing. And I won't even tell you the word that he used about them. And one word, it made sense. So why isn't anybody really addressing it? What would happen if any one of these candidates win? Would they know what to do?
Well, you know, in terms of what, fighting terrorism, you know, I think
about anything. I mean, I get the feeling that they don't even know what to do about education, and that's my field, and healthcare, which I know a lot about. Also, I've never heard anybody address how they're going to fix everything. All they're going to say is so and so doesn't know what he's talking about, and I could do this better. But what is better? No one's ever said to them, "Give me an answer that's not related to what Hillary would do or Trump would do or anybody. What would you do?" And not one of them can
right.
answer any questions.
Well, you know, getting off a little into politics, which, I veer off too often. But, you know, we have to remember, you know, politics is a game. It's a game of words. You know, it's a game of generating emotion. And, you know, hatred is emotional. And if we know from history, if you point the finger at a group of people, if you could find a scapegoat and say these people, or this is the reason for all our problems, it sinks into a certain group of people. And, you know, we sort of sometimes have, I wonder if we have sort of a loud, the loud minority and the silent majority. Sometimes you just hear from those who feel most of this effect or feel revved up. You don't hear from people who are basically satisfied or, you know, just don't have the anger built up in them. They just kind of, you know, don't make their expressions known as much as those who are just really angry and unhappy. So you hear the rhetoric more from that. But, you know, it's a political system that works in terms of, or political ploy, I should say, rather, that works in terms of, you know, generating emotions, negative emotions. This is how we can fix things by, you know, blaming it on them. And, you know, negative campaigning does work. It does work. We know that. You know, I do a lot of speaking when I speak about fraud and crime and theft. Mm. A lot of it comes down to social psychology. You know, I'm an armchair social psychologist. And, you know, I know I just recently gave classes on how to build a strong case, interview and interrogation. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is that an accusation has much more impact than saying, "I didn't do it." So if I came on here and asked, "Fran, I know you did X, Y, and Z," and you say, "No, I didn't," you know, people, without knowing anything, are much more likely going to believe me than they are going to believe you, even though I may have absolutely no basis for my allegation. So allegations work, and I you know, go off the whole thing as to, you know, wrongful convictions, and which is one of my topics these days that I'm on. But, you know, it works. It's very strong. So they make allegations against each other, then someone's put in a position saying, "No, I didn't. And everyone says, "Oh, yeah, of course not. You know, of course he's denying it." But it works. It works from a campaigning point of view, and, well, all's fair, love, war, and politics, I guess, right?
I know, and people just, you know, hear what they want to hear, and they're not really listening to what's really there. And some of them, it's just hard to believe that some of them, one or two of the candidates, actually have the voice of the public. And when they don't really, so as in one particular case, I think it's just a matter of he's pretending to be on his own television show, and he likes to hear his own voice. It's scary. Anyway, when they searched the Bomber brothers' home, what did they find? And can ISIS really ever be stopped? Can they ever figure out just how many? There must be millions of cells of them. There can't just be one specific spot. And how helpful are the surveillance tapes? I mean, how did they find out how to get all of them? Can they never get all of them?
Well, you know, we never know what what we've missed. So let's go back to what you said. So whenever we get a lead, for example, we're going to do a search. And of course, every country has its own rules, its own laws, its own, you know, limitations. Some have no limitations. It just depends on the country. But whenever you make an arrest on a criminal organization, a terrorist organization, network, you are open. It's like a, you know, the center of a wheel, and spokes go out. And you know, 99.9 times out of 100, you're going to get a bunch more leads from that. So whenever you do a search, you're going to, you know, search people's phones, their computers, what we call pocket litter, you know, piece of paper with names, phone numbers, or numbers that appear to be have no significance. And from there, we figure out, you know, where they, you know, certainly with people's phones now, we figure out where they've been, with whom they're communicating, what they've said, and we just kind of open up and spread out that investigation to other people, which leads to more. And I remember when I worked in narcotics, that's exactly how we did it. You know, you arrest one person, we get information from them, and you just keep moving up the ranks, sideways, downwards, wherever it goes to see the cell, and you get more phone records and more computer records, and you just keep going on. Then when you find the key people, you do surveillance on them, you tap their phones, you bug their homes, you do whatever you got to do to increase the investigation. So, you know, that's how it works. So when you go in certain someone's house that they think is a safe house, you get a lot of information. Again, you know, you have you do fingerprints. You're going to find out who else was there. So you open up a wide, wide, you know, array of more investigative leads. So that's how we find them. And you just keep taking it to the next logical step. And what you're hoping, of course, is that during the course of the investigation, you're going to stop a plot in its tracks. You know, get to them before they manage to take out the next. I'm sorry.
Do they do this? Do they do the same to us? Can they spy on us?
Oh, they can certainly try. I mean, you know, certainly any terrorist or criminal organization would love to know what's going on in law enforcement. Look, we just have a, you know, we just this morning it was announced that a Navy officer was, you know, indicted for espionage. So.
Oh, I don't doubt it.
Yeah, no, that was, no, again, it was from another government. Yeah. But during my career, I don't remember, you know, any FBI agent or, you know, law enforcement officer being corrupted by a terrorist organization. Certainly, I've known personally agents who, you know, did get corrupted by the mob. You know, they you know, just forgot who they were. By foreign intelligence, you know, usually by, you know, seduction. You know, get involved with a little pillow talk, things like that. I haven't yet seen the terrorist organization do that, but they may. They may be starting to get that sophisticated. You know, it may have happened overseas that, you know, we don't know about. Of course, we wouldn't be privy to that information. But during my career, I didn't see it happen. But it is certainly a concern. And I got to tell you, one of the things I do worry about is how often I see like FBI agents these days and other law enforcement on social media. And, you know, giving away a lot of, you know, what they do, their pictures. And I'm like, is this really a good idea? I don't know. I don't think it's a great idea to put all the information out there. I mean, it's just one more thing to worry about.
I agree with you. So in tracking somebody's phones and all of that and information and, you know, going on their computers and stuff, Apple would not release the phone records of the guys in San Bernardino. So what happens when you can't get the information? I mean, I just found out I wanted to try to get my bank records from 6 years ago for whatever reason, and the bank told me that they don't have them, and I can't get my own bank records because they don't have them. So I said, what if somebody was investigating somebody for whatever they were doing? Wouldn't they be able to get their old bank records so that they could backtrack them, and they're claiming that it's not true? So how come Apple is they would not release the records?
And I've spoken on that, you know, quite a few times with Apple. Let's understand what exactly the Apple FBI issue was. This was not a matter of handing subpoena for something they had. For example, when I was in the FBI, we subpoena stuff all the time. So, you know, phone records, whatever. And we say, you have this, turn this over to us. You know, usually it was the phone companies. And they did. Apple did not have these records in their possession. They did not have the password in their possession. They did not even have what we call the key to unlocking this phone. So it's not that they had something that they refused to turn over. Right? So they weren't just, you know, refusing to cooperate. The FBI was saying is, we want to decrypt this phone. We need you to create a program that will do that. And Apple was like, wait a second. We don't want to do that. Because that would defeat what we are selling, what we exist for. We exist to create these encrypted phones. For us to do this, you know, it would take work, and it'd be working against our best interest. And, you know, we feel it also violates the concept of privacy, and we want to offer people phones that can't be compromised. Once we create this, you know, the genie's out of the bottle, and there's no putting it back. And people are surprised to hear me say this, but I actually agree with Apple's argument. Not that, you know, again, if I was back in the FBI now, certainly I'd feel the same way. All the FBI wants to do is make sure they're doing a thorough investigation. There's certainly no malintent there. There's nothing wrong in what they're trying to do. But Apple certainly has a legitimate argument, you know, and I believe they are correct when they say it does not stop that phone. I don't believe it does. I was also surprised that whole time. I'd say I was a little surprised that the FBI really needed Apple's help. Between the FBI's ability, CIA, NSA, I mean, we've got some really, really smart people out there in the intelligence community. I found it a little hard to believe that we didn't have the ability to do it on our own, very quietly, you know, without announcing, you know, how they did it.
I agree. That's what I'm saying. I just emailed you. We had a listener, and the person logged out. I don't think they could hear me. I emailed you the name of the person because I know I'm not sure who it is. Anyway, how were they able to? I was reading Simon Gervais's book, The Thin Black Line. I interviewed him 2 weeks ago, and funny that his book was based on, out of nowhere, it's over a year and a half old, based on the fact that there were two attacks at the same time. One of the rest, you know, in two different places. How were they able to pull off two at the same time? And what was the reaction of the people from Belgium? And how did they go on from here? Because they're threatening more attacks in Paris and in Germany and in Britain, I heard this morning.
Well, we're forgetting. I mean, what happened on 9/11? We had four simultaneous attacks against us.
Yeah, I know. I watched it. I watched it on television. I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of, you know, forget that this is not a new concept. It's a scary concept, because, you know, I remember, you know, the issue when the towers hit, you know, when you look at this, all right, as unbelievable as it is, all right, at least now we know what's happened. Then you hit more attacks, oh, my God, where is it going to end? You know, and just the psychological impact of knowing everywhere is vulnerable. Any place is vulnerable. So there's a psychological impact, and of course it's a tactical impact, because you move your manpower one place, and then you have to shift to someplace else, and you sort of almost run out of manpower, you know, not knowing where to go, and then just the general panic that sets in, because you know everyone knows that, you know, it could be you next. So that is just a tactical nightmare that, you know, we don't want to have to confront. But you know, again, I think the more we talk about that, and they see they being the terrorists see the success, I think we might. We're going to see more of that. And I don't think it takes an incredible amount of planning. I mean, these are crude attacks. These aren't military attacks with, you know, great strategy, or, you know, how to get in, get out, you know, minimize casualties. They don't care. They just don't care about human life, even their own. And, you know, that changes the dynamic. I remember when I was going through hostage negotiation training as a young police officer, you know, one thing we always talked about is being – willing to die versus wanting to die. And we used to talk, even the extremists who would take over a building or whatever, which we had back then, they may express a willingness to die, but they wanted to live, and that was always our negotiating tool. But now when you come down to the question of people just who want to die, you know, the whole concept of hostage negotiations from that perspective, you know, has to start changing. So these are multiple attacks. It doesn't take a lot of training. I mean, again, they're crude. It's just a matter of people going out and doing multiple attacks at once. And I think it's just a fight we're going to have to fight. But I've always said is the fight is going to be up front. It's going to be with good intelligence. We have to stop these things before they occur. I think it might have been with you I spoke last time when I discussed the fact that it's going to come down to human intelligence. We have to start infiltrating these organizations. The Israelis are great at infiltrating their enemies and just knowing what's going on in advance. That's going to be the most effective tool.
It's scary, and you have to be brave enough to want to infiltrate and to want to be part of their organization and not get caught. But what happens sometimes, you know, when I lived in the Bronx and I passed by the high schools and I passed by the junior high schools and I hear the kids talking and bullying each other and pranking and nasty and I hate you, I'm going to get you and I'm going to beat your daylights out of you and all of that. It starts somewhere. And we used to have in my school, I mean, I was the dean, so we did peer mediation, and I pretty much was a brave little girl of like 100 and nothing pounds, and I was able to stop a lot of dissension and fights that happened, but you can't stop everything. So how can we bring this back so that kids and parents realize that maybe my child might wind up like that? How scary is that?
Well, you know, I just had this conversation with a couple of young kids earlier this week, last week, talking about when I was growing up. You know, we do the old "I was growing up" routine. But again, you know, I grew up in New York City, even though I'm out of there now, just like, you know, you and everyone else. And, you know, we always had fights, you know, especially boys. We always had fist fights.
Yeah.
But it always ended with uncle. That was it. It always ended with uncle.
Yeah, I remember that.
You know, say uncle. We said uncle. The guy lost. One guy claimed victory. And the next day, if not in the next hour, you were back playing baseball, whatever, and your friends, and it was over. You know, one guy just had to suck it up, and that was the end of it. You know, we never came back with weapons or, you know, or gangs or anything like that. I mean, boys are always going to be boys. I hate to say that. We're not going to stop kids from having fights and saying mean things. Kids do things. You know, and again, we do live in a society that we kind of love toughness. I mean, who's always the hero? The hero's never the nice guy. It's always the tough guy. You know, the guy, that, you know, and look, even in you know, shows that aren't action films, it's always the hero is always the person who's very tough. They spew out, you know, insults, and they have no emotions, and they're mean, you know, and heartless. You know, even parents these days on TV shows, if you watch that, you know, that's part of the comedy. Are these just people who spew out insults, don't care? They almost, in my opinion, reflect, you know, abusive parents, verbally abusive parents. But that's what we kind of value in society now. So I think we need to sort of get back to basics. I think the hardest thing for a parent to see, and this is for all parents, you know, all of us, is when our child, when our own child, you know, is going the wrong way and there's something wrong. And we have to look for those warning signs. I know when I speak about workplace violence, which I speak all too often about, you know, with the media because it happens so often, they say, all right, so what are the red flags and why are we having so much trouble, you know, seeing them? And the problem is we never see it in people that we care for. And, you know, we see someone acting violently or doing something out of character, or you think, ooh, you know, it's hard to say, well, my kid, he was just angry. But, you know, when we see things that just are out of disproportionate to what's going on, or we're very, you know, out of their kid's personality, a parent has to sometimes think, I think my kid needs some help. And it's very hard for any of us, to recognize that. But we have to be willing to say, I think my child, you know, is showing some signs of behavior that is above and beyond kids being kids, and we need intervention.
Oh, I agree with you because I got a phone call from the principal of one of my one of the schools that my niece goes to, and I gathered from someone in my family said to me, so and so is not acting the right way. The child is trying to grow up too fast. That's all the person had to say to me, and I called the person and I said to her, I hear you're not doing well in school. And that's unacceptable, and you know that I'm going to butt in now. And I called their parents, and I said, if you're going to be oblivious, and that's what happens, you're going to be oblivious and think that the world is wonderful and it's sunny out there, and you're going to allow this child to fall by the wayside. I mean, I'm the aunt, and I'm going to mix in. And if you don't like it, I don't care, because I'm not going to let this person mix in, and I did mix in. The principal called my nephew and said, okay, she wants to talk to us, and I'm going to call back this week again. And it's my niece, so I text her every morning to remind her that she should be good in school and listen to her homework and not open up her big mouth. She didn't do anything wrong, she just has a big mouth. And I said, that's not you. And if parents aren't aware, a change of behavior, and if even as an educator, if teachers don't call and say, this child's been an A student, and she was an A student, and she's dropping down to C's and D's and not doing her homework, that's inexcusable, and you've got to stop it before it starts, because that's where it all begins, if they think they can get away
exactly
with one
right.
thing. Yeah.
Right, right. Intervention. And everyone's afraid. Look, at the workplace, I tell people that, you know, we say, look, you got to look at, here are the red flags, and I give training on it, we go through it. You know, and the nice thing is, recently, I gave some training on workplace violence at one organization, and the next day, they called me and said, all right, we have somebody that we think is, you know, the red flags are there. What, you know, what should we do? And we talked about, you know, getting intervention, the different ways available. And, of course, it depends on the company and the use of law enforcement. But it was really a nice feeling to know that people were actually listening and they were willing to do something rather than waiting for, the, you know, some tragedy to occur. And that's what we have to do. Parents, schools, workplace, we have to look for these red flags but take it seriously and understand that, yes, people we love can have things happen to them, and things can go bad with anybody, and we have to be willing to say that.
That's right, because you know what? My husband said to me, "Why are you mixing in?" And I go, "Because that's why I'm here." I said,
"Isn't that
because
your job?"
if my sister were alive, she would have called me and said, "Mix in, it's okay." And when I made this phone call, and I'm going to call tomorrow, I'm going to call the principal of the school because I want to just get a handle on if she's really doing better. Her attitude seems better. She's doing her homework, so she says. But you know what? I'm not one of those people that believes everything that she hears and sees. And I don't make deals with children. Yeah, and I don't make deals. My husband said, "Well, why don't you offer her something special if she does well?" I go, "Yeah, you offer her to graduate or to do very well in school. I don't pay people to do well in school. I never got paid to do well in school. I was told that was my job. And your job as a child is to get an education so that you could be independent and don't need to depend on your parents when you get older." And that was a hard lesson that I learned. But you know what? Nothing was handed to me on the silver platter. So what other countries? I was listening. They said Germany, Britain. Why is it? What is the rationale behind this? Their thinking as to why they would target these particular places. What do they? Why do they hate them so much? Why pick on Britain and all of that?
Yeah, well, it's really Europe. It's Europe in a sense. I mean, the goal of ISIS is kind of to destabilize Europe, and this goes back with a lot of historical, religious connotations that'll be on my expertise. But. Their goal is to destabilize Europe. So this is all part of Europe. It's this vast area that they have easy access to. So I don't know if it's necessarily one country opposed to the other. It's matters of opportunity and matters just all being part of that, of the European continent that they want to destabilize. So,
well, before I forget, because my mind is whatever, no. Thursday,
join the club, yeah.
Thursday I'm supposed to interview J.J. White, DeviantX. I haven't heard from the publicist yet. But next Wednesday, Steve Berry's coming on for the 14th Colony. That should be very interesting. And on May 18th, guess who? Mike Tabman and a whole bunch of Gail Lynn, Stephen Schwarzerly, Alan Jacobson, and Simon Gervais. And we're going to talk about terrorism in general and how you incorporate it in your novels, and what about real life jobs do you incorporate when you're writing these novels, and why are so many authors using terrorism as a basis for writing? Give anybody ideas, or is it just a way of telling people that even in writing it could be stopped, or sometimes some of these people write them and they can't be stopped? It's interesting. And then the book I read, The Day of Wrath, probably was the scariest book I've ever read on ISIS and how they actually succeeded in getting their job done. That was scary. So why is there so much hate in the world? And how do we teach, as an educator, I mean, how do you teach kids to back off and not hate? And would you, it would be interesting for you to write for my magazine, seriously, an article on the red flags and what parents need to do to be more aware, because I don't think there are a lot of parents out there that are paying close attention. And if they are, they're not paying close enough attention.
Right, right. And it's harder, I mean, to pay attention these days because kids have so much access to so much information, and realistically, we just can't stop that. I remember the media came over here to talk to me a few months ago about some of these applications that kids have that, hide their contacts. You need it looks like a calculator, but you need a password, and they're hiding photos. And, sometimes these girls are communicating with older men. And parents are really beating themselves up. And, I think parents have to cut themselves a little slack because you're not going to keep up with your kid in technology. Mm-hmm. It's just not going to happen. And, as soon as we become aware of, an application that they're using, guess what? They're moving on to the next application. Yeah, they find another one. They find another something else. And so to sit there and think you're going to outsmart your kid. And I always tell this story. It goes back now 15 years. So my youngest son was pretty young. And he was on the computer. Again, we're talking more than 15 years ago of the internet. Things were a little different. But I had the internet right outside my bedroom door, right, in an open area. And he was playing an online game. It was a fighting game, violence, fighting with swords and everything. Mm-hmm. And he asked me something about can he call someone, in Florida or something like that out of state. I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, I want to call the guy I met online here, a friend of mine." I said, "No, you can't call." And he said to me, "Well, is it okay if he calls me?" And I said, "Did you give out your phone number to someone on the internet?" And he goes, "Uh-oh."
Oh, God.
So So, you know, so what happened is he did, and what I didn't even realize, again, because I'm watching him, he's out in the open, is that while they're playing this game, they were able to communicate with each other and just, you know, speak. You know, and so I didn't know that. I just thought they're playing a game. And it so happens that he gave me the number. I kind of tracked it. Everything looked okay. And he said to me, well, maybe he'll call me. And I said, no, that kid's not calling you because his dad is probably doing to him what I should be doing to you for, you know, giving out that kind of information. But here I was, you know, in the FBI, very, very aware of the threat, you know, trying to do all the right things, yet right under my own nose. You know, this potential threat was happening. Luckily, my kid spoke up. Luckily, it was nothing critical. And he was too young to have gone anywhere. But to show you, you just can't watch everything these days. So, you know, what are you going to do? Not give a kid a phone or, you know, try to block something on the phone, which you're not going to do. They're going to find a way around it. They'll use a friend's phone. It all comes down to your relationship with your kid. You know, but
I know,
you're trying
scary.
To beat them. Yeah, trying to beat them
it's
in technology.
Scary.
It's just not going to work. Yeah, it's not going to work.
I know. I've been getting, like, strange phone calls from people that use cell phones to tell you that they're members of a bank. And
right,
you know very
right.
well that, you know, a certain cell phone area codes are definitely spam. And what's really funny is that the person's name comes up on the phone. So I just, you know, block them, call reject, and I've got tons of people that try to call me that they can't get through.
Well,
it's scary because the phone company's giving out, they're giving it out, and that's what's even worse. I mean, they can't even stop them. You won $1 million. Well, if that were the case, I wouldn't, you know, need to talk to you.
Well, listen, just for you, since, you know, a little off the subject of terrorism, but since you brought it up,
yeah.
let's warn your listeners here about, you know, the latest scam, which is the IRS
yeah.
scam. And even then, you know, caller ID could be spoofed. It could be manipulated.
Yeah.
So even though your
yeah.
your caller ID might say IRS or Internal Revenue Service, if you get that call, you owe taxes, you're going to be arrested, transfer money now. It's a scam. Any call,
scam, I know.
Any call you get saying you better transfer money now, it's a scam. Where they say someone's been arrested, whatever. Just hang up, it's bull, and just don't fall for it, no matter what the caller ID says. If you have any doubts, what I always tell people, if it's your bank, your IRS, you hang up, and then you contact that entity the way you normally do. So if it's your bank, and they're calling, just hang up, either go down to the bank or call the bank with a number that you already know, not what you see on caller ID, the way you always contact them and verify things yourself, and you'll find out it was fraudulent. But don't ever respond
yeah,
the way they want you to respond. Never do what they tell you to do. Do it your own way.
It's scary because I've been getting stuff from banks, my own banks, and I know that there's an abuse line, so I send it back to them, and they said, oh, thank God you didn't answer it. They say, oh, your deposit didn't go through, and you have to update your information. No, not really. As a matter of fact, my internet company, I got one also, and I kept telling my bank, you need to do something because one of these days there are people that are not savvy, and they're going to wind up in being And the funny part is that you see the person's email address is from some guy in college, EDU number.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
let me get back to this before we have about 10 minutes. So how can all of the EU countries and the United States work together to create an intelligence network that might work for everyone together? Or can't that, or isn't that possible?
Well, we are working together. We do have close allies.
Yeah.
We do share
yeah.
information. You know, again, it's what they do with the, what they do with the information. You know, we can't tell them how to police their own country. You know, and in Europe, they can't tell each other how to police their own countries. You know, it's just the reality of the world. But, you know, certainly since 9/11, even before, but certainly more since 9/11, we do share more with the countries. There's a certain group of countries with whom we have a very close relationship. But again, every country has got to, you know, protect its own data. We always want to be careful of, you know, information being compromised or being misused. So there's always going to be that caution. And there's always going to be, and I mean this, you know, kind of lightly, but, you know, errors in translation. I don't mean that literally. But, you know, but information, you know, gets conveyed to one country. It may not be interpreted with the same sense of urgency that was meant to be with, you know, whatever, human error in that. So, you know, it's never going to be a perfect system. And even when I think about domestically, we always talked about you know, the FBI cooperating with other agencies and the drug wars or something else. But we never, ever want to just put all our information online for anyone to see. Because we always worried about information
okay.
getting out. And then what do you do once it gets leaked out and we can't track that leak? Then everyone's saying, well, why did you put it out there? Then you criticize for not putting it out there. So you can't come up with a happy medium. So you just have to do the best you can, share what you can as much as you can. But you do have to protect the data to a certain extent. So we're always going to have this imperfect system. But we're working pretty well. Not perfectly, but pretty well.
It's hard. There's so many ways that people hack into things. I mean, I can't tell you how many novels I've read in the last month or so where they have different people that work for, you know, in the IT part of the novel, and how they get into different countries and how they can hack into banking and how they can hack into this and how they hack into that. It's scary. And I know that there are people that can actually do that. But there's no foolproof system to block people from actually not being able to get into everything. There's always a way. And I know what spoofing is. Because somebody actually explained to me, I know how to do it also. I just never did, but I know how to do it. But, I mean, what happens if you call somebody and I have a restricted on my phone, so it comes up unknown or whatever, you know, so that no one gets my phone number. But there's a way to get it, I'm sure.
Well, I think even when you call the certain, certainly the 800 numbers, I've done that, and they still pick up your phone number anyway. there is no privacy anymore, and we all need to accept that. There is, not that I don't think we have a right to privacy, but the reality is there is just no more privacy.
I know. I had to. I was a victim of identity takeover, and I called the police department in Chicago, and the guy knew it was me. But yet, when I called in England, in Manchester, Great Britain, the police officer said, if you don't unblock your phone, I'm not going to talk to you. And I was surprised that they didn't have a scrambler there. And I did. I called them and Detective Reynolds. I'll never forget it. And my husband's card got hacked, and it took like about 2 years to get everything straightened out. And he said, you're having too much fun working with the police department. And there was one police department in Chicago that asked if I wanted to be a consultant because my skills were better than theirs. I actually found out who did it. I actually got an operator on the phone from one of the phone companies, I won't say which one, that gave me the names of all the people that lived in this particular building where we knew this happened. And they were able to provide a sting. It went to every bank in the world. It went to all the way to China. So these people were all because somebody, my husband went into the bank and paid a charge card payment at the bank, and somebody from the bank stole his identity. And I don't even I won't do online banking. I just, you know, if I don't go into the bank and do it myself or pay it, whatever, and then on the back of a charge card, I found that one of the safety features is cross out all the information in the back so they can't change your address, which is what happened. If you cross out the box and cross out everything, they can't change your address on them because they're going to want to just blacken it out so that you can't even see that, which is I do all the time. Because somebody, he went into the bank and they took the back of the charge card, changed his address to an address in Chicago. And what was really sick was that the bank, when I told them that they did this, sent another set of plastic to the same people. Maybe they made a mistake the first time.
Right, and so much of it is out of our control. A lot of it's out of our own control. You know, my card has been hacked. My credit card has been hacked a lot. People say, really, how could a retired FBI agent know better? It's got nothing to do with me. I have to use my credit card. And if someone else releases that information, there's not much I can do about it. It's all over the place. A waiter could skim it. I mean, there's just so many vulnerabilities. All you can do is really just watch it, monitor anything you can online, monitor it. You know, every day, every couple of days, look for suspicious activity in your bank account, transfers in or transfers out. I tell people, look for small amounts that come in because sometimes they're just testing your account to see what's going on. So always look anything that's suspicious. And, you know, and sometimes, look, when the credit card company calls me and they say, oh, we've withheld these charges, they say, we apologize for the inconvenience. I always tell them, never apologize. You're doing really well. And the credit card companies are doing really well. They always be alert. And if I have to take a minute to say that's a good charge, I'd rather they be cautious than let these things go through and we're worrying about it later.
I agree with you because I had somebody last year that actually took out a domain in Vietnam on credit card, on my credit card. And you know what happened was the bank didn't put it through. Company that was selling the domain, the website, thought that it was kind of odd for somebody in New York to want to buy one in Vietnam. And for some reason, they didn't put it through, but nobody called me. I looked at my little statement, and I'm going like, I didn't pay $154 for anything because I don't know what this is. And I called up the people, that whoever they were, and they stopped it, and my bank stopped it and got it back, and they back-checked it on their own. I was like, so now if I even see $3 or $1 or anything that doesn't look right, which I did the other day, I went into the bank and I said, what is this? And how come this credit card is charging me more than the others for a minimum payment when I don't owe that much? If you don't ask
mm-hmm.
questions and you don't go in and you don't question it, you're going to have a bigger problem. So before we go, tell everybody about, when are you writing your next book?
Well, actually, I've been a little slow. I've been starting my next book, but you know, just don't, fortunately or unfortunately, you know, since I wrote my first three books, I mm-hmm. got more involved in my businesses. You know, I still do my security consulting. I bought a
mm-hmm.
second business a couple of years ago, that transportation
mm-hmm.
compliance company, nothing to do with security. So I've just been really busy in my businesses to find the time to write. I sat down the other day on a Sunday and went to the coffee shop, knocked out 10 pages of my next novel, and it's kind of been sitting
oh,
there. So I haven't, yeah, so I'm trying to get the next one out. I got a good idea of what I want to write, just finding the time. So I haven't really been writing a whole lot. I have been on the media quite a bit. You know, last week or the week before, Minneapolis flew me up there to discuss the DA's decision on whether or not to prosecute a police officer for shooting someone unarmed. And then I was also called at the same time from Virginia regarding a police officer getting shot. And
mm-hmm.
then by another media asking me again about the FBI Apple issue. So I've been pretty busy with the media lately, and I enjoy that. I like being able to get my opinion out there and give what I feel, at least what I feel, is a fair assessment of what's going on.
I read everything that you do, and I watch every video. I watch them all.
No, thank you.
I comment.
Thank you, Fran.
I do. And my book is coming out. My book is coming out next week. I'm excited.
Oh, fantastic.
Yes. Hidden Truths and Lies, told from
Ooh.
The point of view of the dead person behind the stone. I printed out some copies, actually, and I do have a PDF I can send you. Vincent Zandri, Simon Chavez, Larry Thompson, and Alan Topol gave me blurbs for the front cover, so obviously I must have done this one right. The first
yeah,
four
really.
Stories
yeah,
are,
great names
are, yeah. Are faces stories, and the last two are my attempt at sci-fi. My cousin read it, and she said she's got nightmares, which is great because it's scary.
That's great.
And I've already
exactly.
got the 10 titles for the next one if I get done with some of my book reviews, which are 97,000 inside. Alan Jacobson's book, Spectrum, the first Karen Vale book, I finished that yesterday. Alan, watch out. I'm going to come at you with a book review later. Ella James, I've never read Harlequin, Too Many Harlequins, but Deadly Obsession was really good. The Advocate's Daughter by Anthony Franz. And guess what I'm reading now? And it's not out yet. David Baldacci's The Last Mile. Oh, it's really good. I get them all when I, you know, can get 5 minutes in between anything. I promised that I would write this. And you're aware of the fact that I was going to write something. And when you read one of the stories in the book, I was told that if you write something about, you know, things that really happen, I'd change the name, the place, the everything. I made sure that I was, you know, careful. So when you read it, it might be interesting.
I'm sure
it will be. You know what gets me is that if you ask to, I know that there's a Freedom of Information Act, but when I did email them about the information, they told me I had the wrong person because I was trying to get certain records that I know I'm entitled to, and somebody sent me a thing for the HIPAA law. I go, that has nothing to do with this. So I don't know how you get, somebody's medical records or something like that, you know, and I know you're entitled to them.
Whoa. So, you're trying to get someone else's medical records?
My sister.
Yeah, I don't know that you're
trying.
I'm not sure you are entitled to them, yeah.
Yeah, I know. That's the problem. I'm still trying to figure out.
Yeah, I don't think you are. Yeah, without not an expert in that, but I don't think you are. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. They said that the only person that could get it would be the person she was married to, and he's not gonna.
Right.
So I just have to assume. Much easier than I assume. But anyway.
Yeah, you know how well that works. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. What can I say? What can I tell you? But I'm going to email you a copy of Hidden Truths and Lies, and let me tell you, see what you think about it.
Fantastic. It sounds great. It sounds great.
Yeah, so if you want to write something, that's okay. But if you want to tell everybody where they could get your first three books, because he's going to write the fourth one, because I'm going to make sure he does.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Please, Amazon.com. Just run my name, Michael Tabman, T-A-B-M-A-N. My books are there. Except the magic book. I didn't write that one. That's someone with my same name. But, you know, my two novels and my business book. And the business book has really got me a lot more miles than I ever thought it would get me. I'm still doing a lot of presentations based on the theories I present there. So that was my first book, and it took me a lot further than I thought it would take me. So, yeah, please, I love to hear from readers and tell me what they think. Love feedback.
Well, the books are A+ in my country, and I'm still waiting for you to write the next one because you're going to get Mark Zuccarelli on with you next time too, so we could all talk. It'd be really interesting.
Yes, yes, I told him about that. He's pretty excited about that. Yes, you can talk, baby. Let me tell you.
That would be really great. And Michael's going to be joining me on May 18th when we do a panel show on authors that write terrorism, use terrorism as a major part of their plot, and that would be Michael Tabman, Alan Jacobson, Simon Gervais, Gail Linz, and Stephen Schwartzley. And on that note, everybody have a really, really, really great day. And I think my sister must have heard me up above because the sun's out.
Oh, beautiful.
The sun is out. It's freezing in New York City, people. But what can I say? Michael, thank you so much. And everybody
thank you,
have
friends.
A great day. Okay, bye.
Take care, grandfather.